How you doing?
Hi. I'm doing good. How are you?
Doing really, really, really well. That's how I'm doing.
Oh, wow. That's an unequivocal response, then.
I feel like dancing a jig and singing zippity-doo-dah. How's that?
Well, I'm going to quote you on that.
Yeah, it's just it's a good time right now. I'm very excited about all the changes that are happening and a lot of the old monolithic systems that are crumbling on their own. We don't have to chisel away at them anymore. Now we can start thinking about what's going to replace them. It's very liberating.
Sounds like we've started our conversation already. Great. Well, yeah, I'm winding up this gig of the Warty Serums, and so the whole thing of being a host was something that, well, it's always been quite a challenge for me, and that was a good reason to do it in and of itself. But I figure, as seeing as I'm kind of quitting this gig for now anyway, that I might as well just enjoy it as much as I can in the last stages, and kind of drop the structure and the form and the need to direct it in any way. So, well, having said all that, Joseph, I'm going to fall back on structure now and just ask you to introduce yourself a little bit, just for those out there who don't know who you are and don't have a clue what you're doing. So maybe just to give a little context to whatever we do end up talking about.
Yeah, that's politeness, you know, walk into the room, introduce yourself at the party. I always, you know, whenever people ask me, what do you do? You know, I can't think of what the thing is that I do, but lately there's a term that's been applied to what I do. It was coined by a guy who, a media theorist out of MIT, transmedia, and that's as good as anything right now. And obviously it's a, you know, I'm a model agnostic, so that will change. But right now the buzzword, the term is transmedia. And basically that's a work that transcends the boundaries of any one given media and storylines that cross over mediums. You know, and so you kind of, it's almost like following a thread or following a trail of breadcrumbs, mm-hmm. To get into these stories, and they're narratives that, if done correctly, leap off the page and come to life. What I used to call them was living books, and now transmedia seems to be the thing that you need to say in order to, so people understand what it is that you do. Mm-hmm. And that's literally storytelling that uses print. It uses radio, it uses podcasting, it uses the web, it uses film, it uses video, it uses flash, it uses whatever. It could use telephone calls, it could use you know, interactive voice response robotic systems that call you back, that send you faxes, that, you know, all these kind of things. And if there's anything that kind of is the umbrella of what I do, then that's what I do. And then underneath that are all the disciplines of filmmaking and videography and writing and printing and web and, you know, art and the graffiti and just whatever happens to come along.
So is this transmedia storytelling, is it something that you yourself have discovered yourself doing? I mean, presumably when you started, how long ago did you start?
In the 80s.
So, yeah, it was before there was such a wide spectrum of media to make possible what you're now describing as transmedia storytelling, right?
There was always a wide spectrum of media, but what that spectrum included has changed. Back when I started doing this kind of stuff in the 80s, what I utilized a lot was Xerox, the zine scene, if anybody remembers zines,
right.
Which were self-published magazine type things that came out of the Xerox culture, U.S. Postal and World Postal mail art scenes, which, you know, instead of the network that we have now of computers and cell phones, what you used back then was the mail. You'd have these big long lists of people that you would send stuff to, who would then either add, subtract from the package or the art itself, and then send it on to another list of people. And eventually it might find its way back to you, completely altered, changed, or edified in some way. That was another, you know, circuit that we used. In the late 80s, I got into the bulletin board system, which was kind of the precursor to the internet. These were computers that talked to each other via phone line. not in a continuous mode like they do now on the internet, but basically, you know, like FidoNet and a couple other node-based BBSs were computers, like I had one, that would call up another computer just within the long-distance range on the phone line, and it would transfer all the files that had been flagged for transfer to that computer, who would then call the next computer down the line and pass the files along and add some and pass them along. And, you know, so that's how email and things like email now used to get passed around, and a lot of art. So there was that.
Right.
And, you know, there was pirate radio. You know, so there was other things that you could use back then. And since the internet has come along, I think, you know, if anything, it's all become aggregated under the giant pipe called the internet. But
So, I mean, while you're touring, I was thinking several different thoughts, which I'll try and put together now. One of which was that superficially what you're describing could be confused with what corporations are doing and have always been doing, so far as using as many different forms of media to get across their message and to push their product, yeah, and package it in all these different ways to fit the different media, but it's one common message, yeah? But there is a difference to what you're describing, clearly. Yeah,
I think that the intention is what's different. The methodology sometimes is exactly the same, of like, you know, a giant branding strategy of some sort that says that we're going to be in print and we're going to be, you know, we're going to have ads on the Super Bowl. And the strategy isn't always that different, but I think the intention is different. The storyteller's intention is what, you know, basically what storytellers' intentions have always been, which is to tell stories, to entertain, yes, and educate.
Mm-hmm.
Goes all the way back to, you know, the days when pre-writing, when stories were told and passed around and passed down generations, which is, you know, also important.
Right.
So that every generation got to add their experience to the story. There was a tribal story, several tribal stories, and they, you know, they served a couple of purposes. One, they were, you know, a living history book, so to speak, and another was that they were, you know, educational. These are the things that happened before, and this is what happened when we encountered them, and this is how we dealt with either the effect or the fallout or whatever, you know, whatever the story was. And then, of course, there was the fantastic stories, and I think that the fantastic stories also served to educate as well as entertain. There was always, you know, something behind the story, entertaining as they may be. There was always some sort of lesson to be learned from, you know, from that story, or, you know, some sort of incredibly high bar that was set so that people would aspire to that. You know, probably never to attain it, but at least in aspiring to it, to attain a level higher than what they might normally attain.
So bringing it back to the original question then, what the difference you're describing in intention would be that, like corporations, what have you, they attempt to be entertaining to a degree by packaging and marketing and all the rest of it in order to sell their product, mm-hmm. whereas what you're describing is the entertainment. It also is as a sort of sugarcoating process to get people's attention, but the intention isn't to sell a product, but to forge a connection, a sort of community building and extending. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And then I know, I mean, I can only speak for myself. I know there's lots of people that, you know, that I know that do these kind of storytelling things that everybody has different intention. Like my friend Dave, rest in peace, was a partner of mine for a long time in doing these kind of stories. And his intention was that he just liked to tell good stories. And he was a good storyteller. And he just liked to tell good stories. It's what he did. And that was, he really didn't have any kind of, you know, world changing, enlightenment or anything behind what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
His was just that's what he was here to do. He would tell you that too. That's what I'm here to do. This is what I do.
Right.
And he did it very well. And the fact that he didn't have all these, you know, aspirations and meta reasons on top of what he was doing, I think made what he did a lot very pure.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think I know my original intention when I started putting these things together was I was after a way of storytelling that was more personal than just reading something off a page or watching it on a screen. And so what I found with, you know, back then the living book process, as I called it, but then eventually now it's been called transmedia, was an immersive method so that the body eventually became involved in the imprint of this story, which is very important.
How would the body become involved?
The body intelligence becomes involved because if you feel immersed and it kind of surrounds you, and then the story literally starts to take life, meaning that characters from the story might call you on a phone, or you may get email from a character in the story and you can actually interact with them. When those kind of things start happening, you know, it's a different kind of imprint. There's not that that intellectual removal that you can do when you read something on a page,
right,
or when you see it on the screen.
So then interaction is the key element here.
Yeah, I think so. I think it is. I think it's interaction, and then also there's something to be said about the transgression of the media boundary. You know, it's kind of breaking down of the fourth wall is one way to put it, or breaching of the proscenium is a theatrical way to put it. But, you know, when the actors come off the stage and sit next to you in the theater,
right,
and start having a conversation, it changes the perspective of the story.
And it also, well, the fourth wall you're talking about, you could say it violates, to use a very loaded term, the comfort zone of the audience.
Yeah. Yeah, and that, you know, in that was part of my intention, was that, you know, because I was involved in theater when I was younger, and in transgressive theater especially, where we would take theater on the streets and actually perform things on the streets impromptu. You know, the people's reaction to that was much different than when I was performing on stage and I saw people in the seats of a theater.
Mm-hmm.
So just like you said, there's this comfort zone. There's the proscenium, which says we'll always stay up here and we're always a character that you can remove yourself from. We're never going to come down there and violate your anthropomorphic space. And I think that changes the perspective of the story. Now, you know, eventually what I discovered was it also can heighten the paranoid factor for certain personality types. But that's, you know,
that's a necessary risk, I imagine. Well, it's tying in with something that I've written about. It's actually a book that I published last year, Secret Life of Movies, which is about schizophrenic and shamanic experience in movies. And one of the things that I discovered while writing the book, or hit upon, let's say, is that besides the possibility of movies actually simulating a schizophrenic stroke shamanic experience, the actual act of watching a movie in itself is very similar to the schizophrenic state, because we're cut off from the reality that we're watching. And what I realized while observing this was that this is actually the primary appeal of movies, that we get to experience what we never do in life, which is being a fly on the wall. We can actually be there, like immersed in a reality, without any threat to our own person, without any danger of being exposed or called upon or forced to interact. So we're totally in this safe comfort zone, this forgetting chamber of the movies theater or the cinema screen, and immersed in this reality, but as I say, without any possibility of being seen. And so if that's like a simulation of a schizophrenic experience, there's a cut off. It's like we cut off from our physical being.
Mm-hmm.
While we're watching a movie, we just go into this entirely imaginary space. So what you're describing is closer maybe to the Greek theater of catharsis, in which the audience didn't necessarily participate like directly by interaction, but the Greeks set up theater in such a way that it was tragedy, wasn't it? So it was always unresolved, and then the audience in their own psyches had to resolve the drama that they'd seen.
Yeah, and see, that's part of it. So you've hit on one of my big influences there, obviously. Another one was the observation that because we are such a media saturated culture that, you know, you and I don't, but there are a lot of people out there that literally spend 8 hours a day watching television. Mm. They go to two or three movies a week. They, you know, do all these different kinds of things. And I started to notice that, what was happening was when people were outside of, because they were becoming entrained by that trance they were in, which I kind of equated to a disassociative state, because there is the identification with the protagonist usually right. on the part of the person watching. And then I've done some research into, you know, the disassociative state, and actually experienced it once or twice with the aid of some nutrients. That's what they were. that were specifically formulated to bring that state on. Or at least it was discovered that that was one of the effects of it. And it's a weird state. It's literally like you're watching your life as a movie. Mm. You're completely removed from the I, you know. It's a bizarre state. But then I started to notice that that's how a lot of people were beginning to become entrained, and outside of the experience of watching television, it's almost like they still were.
Right.
So that's when I started to explore the idea of, you know, this media of transgression, which is, you know, how do we pull people into the story, you know, in some sort of attempt, you know, to break the trance, or is there a way to break the trance, or, you know, just playing around with different ideas in that realm. And of course, sacred theater was a very big influence, and the Greeks and tragedy and all these different kinds of things. And then also the breakdown of the formula, because once you get people interacting with the story, you can no longer, or the three-step formula of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis doesn't really work anymore. Mm-hmm. And I like that, because it puts the burden of synthesis back on what used to be called the audience, now called the participant.
Right. So is this the difference between entertainment and escapism, maybe? Because the entertainment is clearly still an element if you're going to draw people in that, but they're not actually able to use it as a way to escape from their mundane lives or their own inner turmoil. In fact, it's going to have the opposite effect. Once they've been lured in, it's actually going to stir that stuff up.
Yeah, hopefully that's the effect. I mean, you know, hopefully it's an initiation of sorts. At least, you know, it resembles something like an initiation of sorts. You know, it's the classic example of the red pill or the blue pill, I know, but, it's, you know, it's something akin to that, which is, you can go on and passively consume media. You know, 'cause all the things that are implicit in turning media into these directions also implies that the broadcast model, meaning one-to-many, goes away. And it becomes more of what's called a narrowcast model, which is a one-to-one. Mm. Meaning that every person who formerly would have been called an audience member or a consumer is now called a participant, and they actually input into the process, meaning that there is no longer passive consumption. There's now an active participation. And so you have to... almost, you know, and I discovered this in building these things time and again, which is it almost, you know, dictates, the system itself almost dictates that you can't have the old forms of media where there's passive consumption and that the storyteller is the one that says point A, point B, point C, but rather you have to be flexible because the input from the audience will affect the outcome of the story, or at least the direction.
Right, like the observation of the experiment influences the outcome, kind of.
Yeah,
phenomenon.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So then, reality TV, would you say, is kind of like a lower octave of this? This is the status quo, or the corporate media complex, whatever you want to call it, intuiting this and trying to adapt and mutate the form in a way that's going to meet that demand, but actually subverting it also, in a sense, because reality TV is really the same old bullshit, isn't it? It just creates the illusion that the audience is participating, but it's kind of like the democratic election process. They're still choosing between Coke and Pepsi in the end, right?
No, you're right. You're right. You know, one of the things that irks me about when people talk about reality TV is that, you know, that it's some sort of liberating factor of television. It's not. You know, it's the people that are on reality TV shows, first of all, are playing to the camera. Mm-hmm. And so nothing has changed. There's no sincerity going on whatsoever. There's definitely no candid camera that's going on there. You know, they are pandering to the camera and therefore pandering to the audience, and the audience is still, you know, passively consuming. The only dynamic that's changed in reality TV really is that they cost next to nothing to make versus a narrative program or like a sitcom or something. And they still make as much money, and that's why the studios like them so much. That's why they like them.
Mm-hmm. And they lure the audience into, rather than transforming the form of entertainment so that the audience actually is, there's an interface between the psyche of the audience and the form, they're luring the audience into the form that's already there, so that now your average Joe gets to be a celebrity and act like a celebrity and feel like a celebrity. And thereby, you know, experience the illusion of actually being one of, you know, becoming one with the corporate media.
I think there's some of that, and then there's also this, you know, the way I look at it, reality television is yet one more step removed from what we were even watching before, which was, you know, scripted narrative.
Right.
What reality television is something that proposes to be, look at the name, reality television. It's something that proposes to be reality, when in fact, like I said, if you know anything about the format, you know that in some cases it's even scripted. They are given direction. They are playing to the camera. They are playing to the audience. So none of it is reality. None of it is things that would be happening in that room if there was no camera.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the dynamics are different. Everything is played for the camera, played for the audience. They're given direction. They're put in an impossible situation, you know. And if you look at that, it's, you know, it's actually, because it's being presented as a reality, it's really one step removed, because at least when you're watching a sitcom, you know, you're not told that this is reality. You're told that this is a sitcom. These are, you know, here's a premise, and here's some actors, many of which who are recognizable as such, are now going to perform this thing as if they were, you know, two guys who were raising a and with reality television, they've kind of removed that and said, you know, we're gonna just roll camera while these people are going through rehab or whatever it is that the premise of the show is. So in a way, if you think about it, it's, you know, it's yet one more signifier and sign removed from what used to be there, which is, you know, two people sitting in a room talking, a sitcom about two people sitting in a room talking, a reality show of two people sitting in a room talking that's really not reality.
But the people can pretend that is reality, and so then they actually get even more deeply entrenched with this media inculcated idea of this is reality, because they're not even able to say, oh, it's just a soap opera. Now they think,
right,
this is what people are actually like.
Exactly. These people are actually doing this, and this is how they always are.
The camera doesn't make any difference. No, no.
But, you know, if you think about it that way, you know, you begin to realize how insidious reality TV really is.
Yeah. Well, but as I was trying to get out earlier, it seems like it's a sort of cynical adaptation process of the media, because if audiences are getting tired with the old soap operas and, you know, all the stories are like played out, and so people's attention isn't being captured or held by the old forms, and so reality TV is a way to grab on to people's attention as it's straying, as it might actually be, and is, of course, moving into these transmedia storytelling forms, and they potentially actually become storytellers rather than just mindless audience members. This is a way to hold their attention and prevent that from happening, maybe.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I don't know if it's that, if that's the intention, but, you know, that definitely is the effect that's been happening. Luckily, you know, modern human consciousness is very fickle, and has a very short attention span. So, you know, I think that whatever this reality craze that's been going on, you know, is probably not going to live much longer, as big as it is. But what's going to take its place is another question altogether. And I think that what you see happening now with things like Ultimate Fighting Championship and some of the things that are coming up, you know, and becoming very popular is more kind of the gladiator spectator,
right?
You know, it's the Roman Colosseum all over again, only writ large on television. So that may be where we go.
Public executions have turned to old-fashioned entertainment.
Yeah. I mean, there already has been a couple of attempts to film and broadcast executions.
Oh.
They've been denied, but it has been attempted. So that tells you that the boys in Hollywood will do it if they're allowed to.
Right. Action snuff movies.
Yeah.
Stars are over the hill.
Yeah. Who knows? I mean, we kind of already have that in a way. If you look at some of these reality shows, every once in a while I zoom through a couple of them and watch like 5-10 minutes to get a taste of what's out there. And it's a good way to, you know, get a pulse on what everybody else is watching and thinking. But yeah, I mean, there's already things out there like Celebrity Rehab and things like that, which basically let's watch this person who used to be famous and rich, you know, deteriorate or maybe die on television. So that's just one step removed from a public execution.
Yeah. So I mean, you were saying right at the start you're in good spirits because the structures were crumbling and something new was moving in. And I know what you mean. I mean, within the community that I do my own transmedia storytelling and podcasting and blogging and forumming and everything else, I feel as though there is a community there which is less and less plugged into the consensus reality culture, and becoming more and more defined, whether that's a good thing in itself. I think it can be become a trap very quickly if it gets too defined. But anyway, my question is, if there is a question at the end of this, is do you feel that it's easy to lose sight of what's actually going on out there? I mean, you did just say that you watch popular TV to keep your finger on the pulse there. But I mean, the sense I get is that if you stay in the little pond of what I call the alternate perceptions community, people who are doing their own forms of media and turning away from, you know, the corporate media, it feels like it's a totally separate morphogenetic field. And then when I check in with the morphogenetic field of consensus reality, I get quite a shock sometimes. Mm-hmm. About how unchanged it is. New York Times is still doing this, and Time magazine is still putting Obama on the cover, and etc., etc. Everything seems to be carrying on as normal. So then the sense I get is that it's not a sort of global transformation that's occurring, but this global split that's just becoming more and more pronounced. Do you ever get that feeling?
I get that feeling in one sense, but, you know, like you said, the big media and the places that used to be the power elite or the information centers of the power elite, there's two ways to look at it. And one is, just like you're saying, they're going along business as usual. Everything's okay, business as usual. But if you look at the numbers, what's happening is the people that resource, use them as a resource for information is, you know, declining.
Mm.
Every day they lose more readers. A couple of years ago, I got called up to New York, and it was the New York Times and the Washington Post who asked me to come in talk to them as a consultant. And they said, we have a problem. And I said, how about if I tell you what it is before you tell me?
Mm-hmm.
The readers that you have are dying, and the ones that you want to gain are not coming on over to you. And they're like, well, that's exactly it. And I said, because you have nothing to tell these kids. Nothing that they want to hear, not in the way they want to hear it, and not what they want to hear. Nothing.
Right.
You guys, you know, you didn't adapt. Just like the record industry, you're going to die. It's that simple. And I mean, they did pay me my consulting fee, but they were not happy. with what I said. you know, and I was just trying to be very honest with them, which is, you know, you had a chance when you could have adapted, but you didn't. And there's a whole myriad of reasons why. Most of it is greed and fear. But, you know, the main point here is that, yes, if I look at the cover of Time magazine or the New York Times, I still see the same old shit. Mm. However, if I look behind the curtain, you know, and I overlook this big talking head that tells me he's the great Oz,
right.
I see a feeble little man who is, you know, withering away quickly. And that's cool. You know, that's why I have hope, is because all these big things which used to be monoliths that stood in the way of what I considered to be human progress, real human progress, you know, are crumbling, you know, at the foundation, and I don't see anything that's going to come to their salvation, and nothing's going to prop them up. And there's going to be this big, huge boom as these buildings fall, and then there's going to be this glorious anarchic, you know, period of decentralization. And then I think small pockets will start to regroup themselves. They already are. So, I mean, some people are doing this in anticipation. You know, like, I've already turned my back on the big media. I don't work with them at all anymore, at all, on any level. Because I don't think that their future, and I just don't care to hear their bullshit anymore, because it's the same old fear-based, greed-based stuff. And it's irrelevant. And finally, what I'm seeing is that there's a couple of generations that are coming up now that have been raised on the internet and raised on the kind of decentralized thinking that comes with that. And you know, not everybody, of course, but, you know, a nice, healthy 2% out there are starting to think about new things in new ways, and actually enacting those and being in new ways and thinking about what they're going to do. And not even thinking about how do we pander to the studios, and how do we pander to the New York Times, and it's not even on their radar, which, you know, is refreshing, because my generation, which really came of age in the 80s, you know, never stopped trying to pander to the big media. And even in the 90s, you know, everybody was like, how do I get a record deal? How do I get a book deal? And, you know, but now all the stuff that people like me and you were preaching in the 90s, which is, you know, fuck the big media, do it yourself. There's been some success stories, and on top of it, the big media monolith, which everybody wanted to go suck on the tit of, is going away. It's dissolving. So it's not even an option, which the great thing is, that's forcing people to sit there and go, what am I going to do? Because I don't have this option anymore, the easy way out. I now have to think for myself, and I now have to turn to other people who are my peers and form communities, and all the things that, you know, the big media and the big monolithic corporate thinking used to breed out of us, which is, you know, there is no thinking like a tribe in a corporation. It's like it's a building full of people who are all trying to kill each other, basically. And somewhere along the way, somehow they managed to muddle and fuddle along, you know, as an entity called a corporation. But if it wasn't for the legal status of being a corporation, if you've ever been in big corporations, and I have, you would have no clue that this was a group of people that were supposed to all be working together for the same cause.
Right. But then how much of that is to do with, like, external structures that are sort of maintaining a way of behavior, which is dog eat dog, and how much is, you know, which is it the chicken or the egg? How much is it that those structures have come into being because of an internal quality or alignment, which is predatorial?
I think there's some of both. I mean, I don't think that we're the people we are because of corporations. I think that it's a little of both. I think corporations are a reflection of who we are. And I think that a lot of the behaviors that we have, you know, get amplified because of the corporate environment. Mm-hmm. And so just like television, like I was saying, it's an entrainment process. If you're in an environment every day, day in, day out, doing a certain thing, you're being entrained to that thing. And that will affect your behavior outside of that environment. And I think that because of the lack of, you know, once these corporations are no longer an option, because I'm hearing it. I'm hearing people that I know that were lifelong corporate employees that were what you would call company men. They're unemployed and have been unemployed for a year and a year and a half, who are coming to me and saying, you know, I had it all wrong. I gave my life and my trust and everything to this corporation that the first time the waters got rough, they overboarded me.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I'm like, yeah, well, now you know why I got out of corporate life, because, you know, there's nothing to give. You know, you're basically dealing with a demon, to use an analogy. And demons only do what demons do, right? And so,
right. But what's going to happen to the demons? I mean, this is kind of what I was getting at, and there's just a million thoughts firing in my head when you're talking, so it's very tricky for me to bring them all down, you know, once I could interject there. But it's like you're quite optimistic, and I am too, but not in the same way. And when you're talking about these structures changing and crumbling and all the rest of it, although I think that may be true, I don't necessarily think that that's actually going to clear the way, because I think that the demon is a very good metaphor, in that I think that these structures have come into being because of a sort of invisible infrastructure, if you will, a morphogenetic field which may not even be human, but mm-hmm. if it is human, it's been around a lot longer than corporations have been around, and that corporations and the, you know, the kind of sort of paramilitary government that we're looking at now and that Alex Jones is raving about and all the rest of it, that's just kind of the latest and maybe the final, most coarsest enactment, like the revelation of the method, bringing all the way to the surface this sort of metaphysical agenda that's been at play in the earth plane for, I would say, thousands of years. Now, I don't want to get too much into occult stuff, because that's all very subjective how we interpret it, but how I would kind of bring it down to earth would be what I call the somebody virus, which is that we all want to be somebody. We all want to be a somebody. And so... Uh-huh. You know, it's been said if you get two people together on a desert island, one of those people will become the government.
Uh-huh.
So then if all these structures collapse, but that metaphysical morphogenetic field is still in place, then these communities will come together and they'll have all of this transmedia storytelling and they'll have all the best intentions in the world. And they'll have all these galactic truths and these esoteric philosophies and all the rest of it that are supposedly transpersonal. But as we've seen pretty clearly with the environmental movement, if it's still populated by people who want to be somebodies, then that same dynamic will take over and they'll end up like the corporations, everybody just wanting to kill everybody.
Well, I think that you're right in the fact that it's something that we do over and over again differently. And it is something that is part of human nature, obviously. Corporations are nothing different than, you know, feudal landlords and, you know, other things that have existed throughout time that are, you know, basically the same thing. Mm. And I don't think that the crumbling that's going on right now is going to, you know, I don't think that everything's going to fall down and then we're all going to sing the Age of Aquarius and we're going to walk into this higher octave, right? I don't believe that. I don't know if we're ever going to do that. And to be honest with you, I hope we don't. I think what's going to happen, though, is that, and this is my observation in looking at history, is that we're living in a time where the old systems have run, they're no longer relevant to life on this planet, human life. Mm. And they're going to crumble, and there's going to be this period of time where we can do some course correction. Not going to be the final course correction, obviously, but we're going to do some course correction. And there's going to be the vacancy to be able to experiment. And and that's what I'm looking forward to, because, you know, I think the next 20 years is going to be very interesting. And that's what I'm looking forward to. I don't think it's any final solution of anything. And you're right. I think we eventually will probably build something right back up that will be some sort of control system and that'll have to fall down again. But the period, hopefully, and I'm not saying this always happens, knock on wood, but sometimes what happens is, a good example is when people got tired of the monarchy in the UK They got on boats and they came over here and they founded something different that was slightly better, at least for a while. Now, the system of the government in the United States has been, you know, nothing less than corrupt for quite a while, but at least for a while, there was this wonderful period of relative freedom where there was a lot of experimentation in ways to live. And you were given you were actually given the freedom to experiment in ways, different ways to live. Not all of them ended up being great. You know, some of them ended up being pretty toxic, but others weren't. And that all I'm saying is that we will have the flexibility and the ability to experiment, I think, with, you know, and I feel it. I really feel it in my bones, is that there's going to be this period of time over the next 20 years where we can get away with experimenting with new ways of being. And that, to me, is exciting.
Well, isn't that what we're doing already?
That's what I said. Some of us are anticipating it and have already started. But there's a lot of people out there. Remember, there's a lot of people out there that are still plugged into the Matrix, so to speak, and they don't know the Matrix is dying. And we can't just write those people off. There are some of those people that will come around. Not all of them, but some of them will. And I'm already seeing, like I said, I'm seeing people that are coming up to me, and I mean, they literally sound like a revolutionary anarchist hippie or something. And these are people that have given the last 15, 20 years of their life to corporate living and corporate thinking and corporate being.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're saying, wait a minute, I had it all wrong. Oh, shit, we got to do something. We have to, you know, and so these are people that never wanted to rock the boat. Right. All they wanted was their brand new BMW and their 6-bedroom house and, you know, their twice a year vacation in the Grand Cayman Islands or whatever it was, that are now starting to talk and think and reflect on things that have to do more to do with life and their place in the universe and less to do with how do I make the next dollar. And that's where I get my you know, giddy anticipation of what's coming. You know, it feels, and obviously, don't get me wrong, I'm not a Pollyanna. I'm not dismissing the fact that conditions like these also are where things like Nazi Germany came from. So we have to be very careful and stay alert. But, you know, there's also been some great things that have happened in vacancies. So I'm trying to remain optimistic, but also alert.
So you wouldn't be optimistic if you put more credence in the Alex Jones kind of scenario for the next 20 years?
No, I wouldn't. And you know, the thing about Alex Jones is I had a bill that I started back in 2002, somewhere around there. And it was called Stare. It was one of the first group blogs. It was kind of like Boing Boing. We had a lot of traffic. And some of the people that started that blog with me were responsible for starting Infowars.com. And when that first started, the stuff and I promoted it pretty heavily. And that when the stuff that was coming out of there originally seemed like there was just some people who had some questions about not all of this stuff about 9/11 seems right. And I got to be honest with you, I'm not a person who believes in controlled demolition or mind controlled people flying the planes or any of that kind of stuff. I really do think it was a group of terrorists out of Saudi Arabia that flew the planes into the building, possibly. That the U.S. government or sections of the government may have known about and let happen. That's about as far as I go with it. All this, and that's kind of what was coming out of Infowars.com in the beginning, and then it started to ratchet up into the direction that it's going now. So I dropped my support for it, and it's specifically because what I was hearing coming out of that camp was fear mongering, and anybody who does that, which is, you know, they fearmonger for a reaction, and it's usually to rally troops of some sort, even if it's to sell DVDs or whatever. You know, what I can sniff that out pretty quickly, and that's what I got coming from that direction. So I don't think that you and I are going to be marched off to a FEMA camp tomorrow. So that's why I'm optimistic.
Well, I'm not sure how to respond now. Again, I had all these different thoughts. One of them, first one was what about hope mongering? Because
well, that's why I said I'm not being Pollyanna about this. I do recognize, and I am being vigilant to the very fact that in times of the, you know, times of crisis in history, such as we are facing in the United States at this time, that this has also been the conditions where fascism has risen out of. And so I'm, you know, I'm being vigilant, but I'm also hearing enough things around me and witnessing enough things, even creeping up in the edges of the media. There are little messages that, you know, and the media has to acknowledge sometimes what's going on in the body politic. And so they are acknowledging that people are sick of the same old shit.
Right.
That, you know, this all came down. We're all broke now. Everything's broken. States are going bankrupt. You know, we can't fix the roads. We can't educate our children, et cetera, et cetera. And so people are saying, you know, let's try something. Maybe we need to try something different. They're not saying let's try something different yet. But what I am hearing is maybe we need to try something different here.
Which is also going on with the environmental, the whole environmental thing. I mean, it's, isn't it sort of a continuation or an extension of that kind of supposed awakening to the environmental crisis?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of that is definitely being orchestrated and used to sell more stuff. And I definitely heard a lot of that coming out of the Obama administration when they came into power, which is, we're green. That's where the new jobs are going to be, you know. And I was just like, oh, not another bubble, you know. But that really is kind of what it was. Everybody has a bubble. The Clinton administration had the internet. The Bush administration had the housing bubble. And now I think Obama's trying to strike two pieces of flint together and start the green bubble. but, you know, I mean, there's an aspect of it. But with everything, you know, there is an aspect of it where the media or the powers that be, the corporate interests, are trying to utilize that to sell something, obviously. But there's another aspect of it, which is true. I don't know if I'm a global warming person, but I do know that there are a lot of people on this planet, probably more than need to be on this planet, as far as like sustainability. And that if we are all going to live on this planet together, then we need to figure something out, a different way to live.
I kind of want to try and narrow in on something. It's not going to be easy, but I'll give it my best shot, which is, sure. you mentioned the 9/11 and like that you wanted to let people know where you're at and be honest about that. And so it was useful to me because it let me know like what a discrepancy there is between our two perspectives. So seeing as we're having a conversation here more than an interview, I'm going to try and give you an idea of my perspective and sure, juxtapose it with yours. You know, I don't listen to Alex Jones. I don't have any time for him at all, and I agree that he's a fearmonger, and it's you know, there's nothing for me to gain from listening to that or buying into that kind of narrative. But on the other hand, from what I do know about Alex Jones, it's pretty close to the way that I viewed things for the last 15 or 20 years, and only in the last couple of years have I ceased to view them that way, not because I no longer believe that, but because it no longer seems relevant, you know, either way. And until I see the black helicopters and the paratroops marching down Main Street in my town, you know, I'm not going to concern myself about it, because I'm not an activist anyway. I'm not going to go out there with a bullhorn. So in general, big picture stuff is what I'm letting go of now. That said, I'm the kind of guy who doesn't believe anything that he sees. So with 9/11, I don't even believe that there were planes involved. I'm quite open to the possibility that they were holograms and that the towers were zapped by any kind of sci-fi technology. I don't even know if there's 6 billion people on the planet. I actually don't believe anything unless I've had direct experience of it, and then I doubt it. Even then, I doubt it to some extent, because my thoughts and feelings and even my intuition can deceive me. So what's been happening for me, Joe, over the last couple of years is letting go of all that, what I call paranoid awareness, just letting it go and just see what's there, you know, when all that falls away, you know, what's left that I actually know. And that's kind of, I think that's our only compass, really, in the maelstrom that we're in the midst of, is tuning into that knowing, that body knowing. It kind of brings it back to what you're talking about with the key to this interactive transmedia storytelling being the body imprint, I think, in some way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, but just to kind of finish this somewhat awkward summary of where I'm at, I still have a very strong sense, which feels to me like a body knowing, that we are in a sort of Armageddon time. And I'm not a Christian, so I don't believe in a war between God and Satan. But I do believe in a sort of tension in the psyche and in the species, which probably has to do with the morphogenetic fields that I was talking about before, between reality and illusion. And so if a species creates a sort of surrogate reality based on their personal investments in being a somebody, in being individual beings who can pursue their own agendas, yada, 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 which, you know, we're living in a society and a culture where that somebody sort of intent, that agenda of let's make things happen, let's take charge of our destiny, you know, this separateness from nature, that's really, we don't really know any different. But that to me is a basic illusion, because, you know, from my galactic point of view, which I admit I don't have without the use of psychedelic drugs, but and very deep visionary dreaming, but it's still one that is backed up by what we know about science and what have you, that, and even by observation, you know, the universe is a living intelligent system. It is intelligence. If there's intelligence within the universe, then the universe is intelligent. That's how I see it. So then, if the whole system is intelligent, then the idea that we as particles or individuals within that system have any sort of volitional capacity has to be an illusion. Like the planets and the stars and what have you, they can't actually be perceived as separate from that whole gyroscopic system of the galaxy. You know? So then we're the same way. So then if we create this illusory sort of bubble that you were talking about of our self-willed agenda and our personal sovereignty, then that the only way that can exist is by opposing itself to truth, to reality, like a cancer in the body, let's say. And so then the more that reality or truth begins to come into form within an arena, let's say the Earth plane, which would entail factors beyond our comprehension, but also what would be within our comprehension, the more people as individuals begin to actually let go of their own shields and their own false programmed desires and just enter into a state of being where they're tuning into reality, that would increase that the pull of this new morphogenetic field, then that would create this tension. Those like in the Matrix, you know, those are plugged in, they're going to fight to the death to defend the program.
Mm-hmm.
So then this tension, this is what I see as the Armageddon dynamic, why I do believe in Armageddon without any of the Christian symbolism being necessary. I mean, you can use it or not, but I don't actually believe in, you know, those things as realities outside of the psyche, but just as interpretations of psychic realities. But the idea of a tension between truth and untruth, or reality and an illusion, I do believe in, because I live with it every day. You know, it's in my own head, like every minute, really. And so what I perceive is all these bizarre conspiracy theories, as far as David Icke and the reptilians, to me, they are, in a way, they're closer to reality, because they're a more all-embracive, all-inclusive narrative to that that's on Time magazine and New York Times and what have you. That's the cover story. Now, what the cover story is covering isn't what David Icke or Alex Jones are revealing either. That's just another layer. But I would say, like with an onion, you are getting closer to the core. the closer you get to the sort of mythic narrative, which allows for this transpersonal galactic conspiracy, if you will, which isn't really a conspiracy, it's just the universe. But if we perceive it from a personal point of view and interpret it, filter it through our personal little egos, it sort of crystallizes into a narrative that is personal, and then you have a globic galactic conspiracy complete with reptilians and Illuminati bloodlines and all the rest. So point is that although I don't believe in those narratives, they actually work for me, or have worked for me, a lot better than the official story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't disagree with anything you said. In fact, one of the reasons that I indulge in reading this conspiracy theory stuff, and I mean, I don't immerse myself in it, but I do read David Icke and other people of that ilk, is because I think that there is more of a, like you said, there's more of a truth there. And I think that the reason that there's more of a truth there is that it's coming from a more raw place. Or maybe, if, you know, what a Jungian would say is that it's more representative of the collective unconscious.
Right.
And I, you know, that's why I appreciate it for what it is. I don't believe it, but I don't believe anything, ultimately. But the, you know, the, and one of the things that you, you know, you were talking about is like this letting go and getting down to that base level. One of the things that my hope is that, in the disintegration that's going on around us, one of the things that is disintegrating is the stranglehold of distraction that surrounds us, especially in this American culture. It seems to be everywhere. Everywhere you turn, there's a billboard vying for your attention. There's a TV in the corner. You know, there's always something flashing at you and yelling at you and saying, "Hey, over here!" And there's lots of places to go stick your head in the sand. You know, television, theaters, whatever, iPods, all these things that are going around. And with the disintegration of the infrastructure that supports all that, as that becomes less available to people, I think that they are almost forced in on themselves. And like I said, not everybody's going to unplug. There's always going to be that person that fights to the death, or there's going to be the person who says, "I know the steak that I'm eating isn't real, but I don't care." Mm-hmm. I've met those people. Literally, you know, I have. And that's, you know, and they're always going to be those people. So that I don't despair at that. What I keep looking for and finding is, you know, people that are starting to come kind of wake up and come out of the daze a little bit and look around. They're starting to look around. And yeah, it's not the majority out there, but it's a larger number than I've ever seen in my lifetime.
Mm.
I was too young in the 60s to really speak about what people that were there told me that was an era where that began. And it was beginning to happen. And then there was a lot of things that happened that kind of shut it down. But I wasn't there, so I can't speak to that. I don't really know if that did occur, if that was just them looking back fondly at an era of their youth. But
how old were you in the 60s?
I was born in 61. Hmm. So I was, you know, I was young. I was in the middle of watching it happen. I grew up in Chicago. I did actually see, you know, the whole thing that went down with the Democratic National Convention. But, you know, I was young. What did I know? I was just watching these hippies who I thought were cool doing cool things, or things that I thought were cool because they were hippies. But like I said, people that I know that were of that era and in that counterculture in that time, you know, told me that at least in the beginning, there seemed to be a lot of, you know, a large number of people that were waking up and looking around. And I feel like, and again, that's why I said, we look back at history and the, you know, it's not like the doors open and the fifth dimension starts singing, you know, Age of Aquarius. That's not how it works. Although there's a lot of people that think that's how it works. But, you know, what happens is a door opens and, you know, there's 2% of the population starts to look around. And of that, about 1%. Actually makes some sort of drastic change for the better for themselves. And in doing so, hopefully what they do is they become one more node in that morphogenetic resonance field, that separate one that we're talking about here, that second one, that is the mutational curve. Because if you look at the way a species, you know, mutates over time, it usually starts out with about 2% of the total population as the mutation.
Right.
And then the other 98% eventually evaporate because it's not adaptable or didn't adapt to the changing environment, to the changing condition. So that may be what we're seeing again here. You know, and if nothing else, I think that, I mean, I just, you know, I'm not trying to be Pollyanna, but if nothing else, if, you know, a couple hundred thousand people worldwide just wake up and change their life for the better, I mean, that's not a bad thing. If that's all that happens, that's better than it was yesterday.
So you don't think they'd just get round up and stuck in the relocation centers?
I don't, you know, I really just, intuitively speaking, and I'm pretty good about this, I have this weird ability to kind of map things that are going to happen in the future. That's why I've been so successful in technology. Mm. And I don't see it happening. I got to be honest with you. That's not to say I couldn't be wrong, and I'm not going to, it's not to say that I'm not going to be vigilant, because like I said, again, when you're dealing with a situation that we're on the cusp of right now, you're dealing with an unknown quantity. You're dealing with, you know, the edge of a fractal. We're dealing with a nonlinear dynamic system at this point, right? We're coming out of a linear system that was built around us, i.e. the matrix or this culture that we live in, as the metaphor, going into a lack of control, or less control at least, which allows for the arisal of chaos, right? And chaos can be a destructive force or a creative force or both, which means that as things collapse, it makes way for things to arise. As order disintegrates, it makes way for a new order to arise. And that can you can interpret that a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
And so, like I said, you know, it's up to each one of us individuals out there who are paying attention to all this, vigilant, and you know, watch for the signs of some sort of totalitarian state, or, you know, they're coming to round us up and put us in the camps and those kind of things. But I just don't get the feeling of that yet. I don't, because I see too many people who are awake right now and are waking up. And that makes me at least know that there could be a raft that we could all build and go somewhere else together.
Tune in to part two of this conversation with Joseph Matheny 4 days from now.